The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at an historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laugh as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's give it up for the breakout star of our program, super producer, the one and only Mr. Max Williams.
What? Kids going places.
He's going places. This podcasting thing just might work out for him. They call me Ben. You're Noel. And Noel, this is, I think, a special episode for us. It's one that we've been pretty excited about. I almost don't want to spoil it. Should we just... Okay, let's just talk about this.
I mean, it's, you know, it's in the title. People probably kind of have at least an inkling as to what's going on.
I thought
so. But if they don't, yeah.
Is it possible to
spoil reality television, though? I mean, I guess it is. You know, that's all...
Sure.
There's moments. There's cliffhangers. There's big reveals. Yeah. It's just another form of drama, right?
Mm-hmm. Before we get to our big reveal today, folks, we do need to point out that... this is an episode about reality television, which can be divisive. If you hate reality television, you're going to have fun here still. If you love it, you're going to hopefully still have fun, because love it or hate it, reality TV is one of the most popular television formats on the planet. It's also, you'll hear it called, in corporate parlance, unscripted programming, just meaning that performers involved aren't really working from a script. In theory. Today, there are countless different versions of this sort of thing in every subject or genre imaginable, from like the hazards of love to surviving in the wild to cooking to hunting ghosts. But how do we get here? Today's question, what's the history of reality television? Noel, I think it's time for our first big reveal.
Oh, yeah. Other things of love, too, right? There's hazards. There's rocks. There's lots of love-related ones. But yeah, big reveal is that the history of reality television, unscripted as you coyly refer to it as well, is ridiculous. It's absurd. It's not just a little bit divisive for good reason. It's like wrestling. I think some people don't know that it's not entirely real.
Hey, kayfabe. Hashtag kayfabe.
Yeah, whatever that means. I don't know what that is. What is kayfabe?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. It'll land for some people listening.
Got it. Okay,
it's the idea of maintaining the illusion. But that's not the big reveal, Noel. The big reveal is that we're not going into this alone, right?
How could we? How could we ever venture into these dark waters alone? No, today we are thrilled to be joined with our very special guest and good friend, Anna Hosnay, who produces tons of shows here at iHeart, including Daily Zeitgeist. She's the creator and co-host of Ethically Ambiguous, the founder of the fantastic iHeart Next Up Initiative, which gives opportunities to young podcasters from various backgrounds and underserved demographics. And of course, a regular contributor and producer of Will You Accept This Rose? Anna, will you accept this guest spot on Ridiculous History today?
Yes, I will. Thank you for having me. What about no?
Then we would have a cliffhanger.
There'd be a cliffhanger here. We'd regroup and we'd figure out how to press on. But it wouldn't be as fun.
I'd go into VO voice, making it sound like an ad break, and say, I'm not going to do it now. Because you said yes. You can also check Anna on Twitch, where she hosts Deckheads, Chief Stews. And Anna, this is where you talk about Below Deck and a ton of other Bravo shows like The Real Housewives Empire, Summer House, Southern Charm, you name it. We made it happen. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining us today. For anybody who's not aware or didn't get the vibe from all the stuff we just listed, Anna is very, very busy. And her contract, the writer in her contract, is crazy. So we had to save up for this.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Actually, it states that you guys all have to watch reality TV with me for a week.
I'm here for
before
it.
I'll come do any show.
So there's what we were hoping to do in this story with our resident expert on reality television, which is, of course, Anna, is to look at the true history of how this became such a global phenomenon. And I don't know about you all, but before I was really diving into the research on this, I had just sort of assumed reality TV was kind of a thing that birthed in the 1990s. I think we all remember the Real World program on MTV, right? Like Shout Out Puck, I guess that's what very young me remembers.
Weird Beard. I remember Weird Beard, his like alter ego. I don't know why that stands out. Then there was that British guy that was in like the metal band who sent his girlfriend like a pig's heart with a nail through it or something. What was that guy's name? A lot of weirdos on the show.
I don't know.
It I remember like him. I don't remember his name.
It was a British sounding name, but yeah, that was like only season two. I think it was New York and then London, maybe. And then there was San Francisco in there. I think San Francisco was with
Seattle.
Luck. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Seattle was also big. But no, it's true. I mean, it's something that I, you know, certainly was like on, just kind of like you couldn't really escape it because it was huge. It really hit some kind of like note in the zeitgeist, and it really hasn't slowed from there. It's sort of just spread like a disease. Or you know, a positive disease if you're into it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like one of the fun diseases, you know, like that laughing epidemic.
But Anna, first off, how did you get into it? Like, it's obviously something that you can be into ironically, sure, and you know, kind of it gives you plenty of fodder for like commentary that can be a lot of fun. But I think a lot of people truly, you know, do enjoy following the lies. Which camp do you find yourself in, or is it somewhere in between the two?
I would say I'm a little in between. Like, I love reality television unironically. I think it's just great work. I think look, scripted television, you have a writer's group, a writer's team, you got people working on it. Everyone's like, you got some of the best minds putting something together. With reality TV, it's so unpredictable. And it's so like, also you have to go find real people, which is really difficult because not only do you have to find them, then you have to actually make sure that they're like good to be on TV. And there's like so many levels to finding these like incredible characters that we've become genuinely obsessed with that like I can't help but be like, this is masterwork of television. This is tough. I worked in reality TV very briefly. I couldn't cut it. I hated actually working it, and I had to step away and just enjoy it from afar.
Oh, wow. So you know the behind the scenes, like challenges and the plot twists people have to navigate. I was unaware of that. We're going to have to pick your brain about that in a little bit. You make incredibly salient points. And I think a lot of people aren't aware of that amount of work, right? They think there's just this kooky person, right, who is starting a strudel empire for some reason. And now, 9 seasons later, we can say, wow, that actually worked out. One thing I think maybe we can start with is the tricky proposition of defining what reality or unscripted programming means. I think we can all agree the definition expanded over time. You are, again, our resident expert here. It seems to me that some people will define reality TV in a very narrow scope, and they'll say it's kind of soap opera. You know, it's kind of slice of life, increasingly with a celebrity, and you're just learning about and following the adventures of these normal, very interesting, compelling people. But other folks will broaden the definition increasingly, and they'll say, well, what? Why is a insert game show here? Why is that not reality television? A lot of the stuff is unscripted. Or why are those kind of documentary things that are not soap operas, why do we not qualify those as reality television? And there's a lot of curation that goes into this from the, you know, the dailies to the final product. But the more I looked into it, I was surprised that there are conflicting opinions about what the actual first reality television show is. And off mic, I sent around to our crew here a show that is often called a, it's like a prototype of what would become reality television. It's a game show called Queen for a Day. I had never heard of this one, and it really creeped me out. This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
If we've learned anything in the process of doing this podcast, just living life, it's that there's always a catch.
So when we heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month if you get a 3-month plan, we looked at each other and we thought, nah, what's the catch?
But here's the thing. In this case, there isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online.
Yeah, they cut out that middleman cost of retail stores and they pass those sweet, sweet savings directly to you. We're not joking. We have tried out Mint Mobile ourselves and it's super convenient. And it actually, like, we tried to find a catch and there's not one.
So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan.
Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, it's pretty dystopian. What did you know about this one, Anna?
Well, I had heard of it very briefly as like, because I read a book called Bachelor Nation by LA Times writer Amy Kaufman. I read any Bachelor or any sort of reality TV book. I won't read like anything legit, but if you're like a book about reality TV history, well, you know, it's already in my cart. So I did actually, she briefly mentioned that show in her book, but like, I never did any further research on it. I was kind of like, okay, sounds like some Johnny Carson, you know, like I was just like, whatever, sounds old. So I never really like got into it or really researched it further. But that video you sent me where like the mini doc on it, I was like, oh, this makes all the sense in the world. We've always been obsessed with perfect people in media and it goes so far back. And there is like that level of darkness. It's such a precursor to like The Swan. Do you guys remember The Swan where they like took a woman? Mm-hmm. They were like, ah, she's a freak and like made her beautiful. When you're like most of those women, you were like, they're fine, you know?
They were fine. Come on.
So it's interesting to see that.
Yeah, no, this one, I mean, it is, it really embodies the kind of sexist, you know, misogynist, like, hierarchy of, like, the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and honestly, beyond. But with this whole notion of, like, what if we took an underappreciated poor woman and gave her all the things that she needs to feel like a queen for a day, and then put a crown on her and parade her around like something out of, like, a horror movie. I mean, it really does strike me as, like, this kind of ritualistic, you know, display. I don't know, something about it. I can't quite put my finger on it, Ben. You keep using the term, you know, or dystopian.
I say Hunger
kind
Game
of terms.
Vibes.
Yeah, but there's something about it that is very unsettling. And I don't know what it is, but can you kind of describe to us, Ben, what you found in your research as to what the whole deal was around this game how you won exactly? I don't even know if there is a winner per se.
Yeah, we all four watched this on this mini doc, as you mentioned. And this show dates back to the Mutual Radio Network in April of 1945. It was in New York City before it moved to LA. And then it ran until 1957. And then it switched to NBC. And it's growing the entire time. This is really important. And then it goes to ABC and runs till 1964. Like you all said, it opens with a host. He's very, Anna? He's very, like, old. And he's, you know, like the old school
old
TV host.
Older white gentleman judging your looks.
Yes. Which of you is the saddest?
Yeah.
Exactly. So the way the format works, it is kind of like game show variety, but in a very dark way. He introduces a series of contestants. All contestants are women, female identifying, who have a personal tragedy or struggle, something that is beyond ordinary means to repair. So that even though it's called Queen for a Day, they don't come in happy, just wanting to be happier. They come in saying, someone, beat me here, Max. They come in saying, someone fucking help me with my sick child, or someone Babe. Help me save our house. Perfect. Perfect timing there, Max. So he interviews the contestants, and then, you know, they're separated, the interviews by commercials. People love this. If you have the saddest story judged by the audience applause-o-meter, then you get some version of your wish for a day. And you can see stuff where someone's like, I want medical treatment for, you know, my little Jane or my little Jimmy.
Jesus.
And then they're like, we heard you, and here's a brand new dishwasher, the finest from Maytag and Sears, or whatever. And this show was so successful that it was 30 minutes, and they increased it to 45 minutes just to put in more commercials, which I think remains a complaint about a lot of reality TV today.
But I mean, the most macabre part of it to me is that in the end, the winner is selected and they're announced with all these prizes they're going to get. But then they're like dressed in this like weird kingly, queenly robe, you know, with a bejeweled crown, all while, you know, sitting in this like absurd velvet, you know, plush throne and given like a dozen roses. And I don't think this is necessarily the case, but I'm picturing them also openly weeping, mascara like running down, like the cover of that whole album, you know? I mean, it's just, it's kind of twisted. They didn't seem to think so, I guess, you know, but I think this really does point to an interesting factor for me, at least about reality television. I think one thing that's always led to it being a success is something very similar to why I think true crime is a success. It gives people an opportunity to be like, well, at least I'm not that poor, or at least, you know, my father wasn't a secret murderer. You know, there is some sort of like remove with which people can watch these things that allows them to kind of feel a little better about their lot in life, or worse, depending on what show you're into and what you're, you know, what you're after. But I mean, Anna, do you have any thoughts as to why these shows are so popular on such a broad scale outside of just, you know, the soap opera-ness of it all?
Oh, Noel. You've asked a question I can talk about for 8 hours. Okay, well, here, let me break down the Queen for a Day. So you're seeing something where you're seeing these like ordinary women who have problems. Guess what? America loves drama, you guys. We've always loved drama. This mini doc, I was like, this foreshadows every trope in reality TV history to come.
Right.
So you have the trauma. Guess what? In like the Bachelor sort of like dating world, there's this concept of trauma bonding where you're like, if you're a bachelor or bachelorette, don't be like, I need you to open up to me so I can know that we can have something. But to them, opening up means like, tell me something traumatic from your life so we can trauma bond. And then we'll feel like we have something, which in any normal circumstance, you're dating. The first date, you're not going to be like, my parents got divorced. And because of that, I had to become like the sole like sibling who raised my other siblings. It was really hard. My mom worked 18 jobs a day. I had to do everything. It really put a lot of pressure on me. And that is why I think I'm ready for marriage. You know, it's like all these really weird things where you're like, whoa, okay, you didn't have to tell. I mean, divorces, while yes, I believe it can be very hard on you, it's incredibly common at this point, you know, like a lot of people get divorced. But then, so you're seeing that, the sort of like trauma bond. And then you're kind of seeing this other thing of like, a lot of our obsessions is like projecting our own sort of feelings on people. So you're able to be like, wow, look at her. She got that. She won her dishwasher. She's the queen of the day. But then you're not the one who has to like deal with the aftermath of that. So, hey, you get this dishwasher, or in like a lot of those like television or like house remodel shows, you know, like Ty, I forgot that guy's Ty something, where he'd be like, here's Pennington. Your new house. Yes. Pennington? Is it Pennington?
I don't know. I think so.
Something like that. Sounds familiar.
Now you have to pay the property taxes and you know, pay for everything.
Exactly. It's like, oh, well, I wasn't super rich. I can't afford a massive house like you just built. I mean, like, I love it. Cute. I can't actually afford that. And a lot of those houses go into foreclosure. So like, there's almost like this moment of like, yeah, that's great. But you're in the safety of your home. So you don't, as soon as that show ends, it's not your problem. And I think like, as Americans, you see that a lot where we're like, ooh, yeah, good for you. But that's not my problem. We like to really pull back. And that's a symptom of just American culture in general, which is why so many people are suffering in this country, is because we're like, well, I did my job. Why do I have to give, you know, like, we're all kind of like selfish. It just is what it is. So there is like this level of like, I can project everything I'm feeling into this half hour or hour or 2 hours now, because they never end, television show. And then I can walk away and I can be like, wasn't that crazy? She's a nut, you know, and then it's not your problem anymore. But like, you get to literally suck the joy out of this television show and then walk away, you know, wipe your hands of it. And that's, I think, like our kind of sick fascination. And I think Queen for the Day is a very interesting foreshadowing of every little thing that's going to like come out. And competition. We love to compete in this country. We love to compete. So the idea of like, whose story is sadder, is like such a like sickening obsession of ours. Because we do also love to tear up.
But they didn't even try to veil it. You got to at least give them props for not even bothering trying to dress it up.
No,
they literally
don't.
Are asking the audience whose story is sadder, you know?
Exactly.
Because it was the first time out. They hadn't learned the tricks. Yeah, that catharsis, right? That vicarious experience.
Yeah.
I agree. It carries on.
We love a beautiful story.
Even
if it's like has
story.
A dark, dark origin where you're like, she's being used to sell ads, you know? And anyway, right. That's why we're obsessed. We love stuff like that.
Also, to jump in real quick.
Yeah, Max, give it to us.
It is Tigert Burton Ty Pennington.
Oh, love that.
Oh,
of course, Tigert.
Max with
classic
the facts.
First name.
We just paused for this awesome sound cue on where we have a friend singing this theme song, Max from the Facts.
Where do we even go from Queen for a Day? I mean, it gets kind of lighter after that. I mean, we sort of start with like the most, you know, bleak dregs of kind of human misery. And then we go pretty quickly to like prank shows, you know, and like candid camera, right?
Yeah, you know, it's... Again, it all hinges on what we accept as the definition of reality TV, which I think I'm kind of team Anna in this one, because maybe the best way to arrive at the definition is reverse engineering from what fascinates people about these shows, these programs, these formats. You'll find a lot of people who will argue, no, the real first reality TV show was so-and-so. So let's just walk through some of the first ones. One of the first network game shows, Cash and Carry, that shows us unscripted television. But again, it depends. Some people will say, well, a game show is not reality TV, but a competition that is kind of game show based. I think we can point to several that are reality television. And there's a really interesting interview with a guy named Troy DeVold, who has produced and written for numerous properties like this, and is kind of an historian of reality TV. And he says that the very first reality television show, per his opinion, is something called Amateur Hour by Ted Mack. It came out in 1948, a few months before Candid Camera hit the screens. And right now, Candid Camera, I think, is more well-known. I've never actually seen an episode. I think it's one of those things, just the kind of floating around in popular culture. I know the phrase Candid Camera, but I haven't
You've never seen Candid Camera?
I have not.
Legendary television.
Really?
I was raised on Candid Camera. I loved it. It's so funny. It's so funny. And also another kind of hilarious thing where we love to see people make a fool out of themselves / get hurt.
Got caught out. Right. And then say, I'm sure they're fine at the end. Right. And come back.
Well, they
back
win like, a, you know, whatever. They win something. And you're like, that should be enough.
That's
the modern equivalent, I guess, would be like fail videos, you know, or like kids getting hurt accounts. Yeah, fail. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't even need these kind of shows anymore, because I think they've kind of found their place in shorter form videos on the internet.
I know. Well, that was also America's Funniest Home Videos.
Yes. Yes.
Literally homemade joy.
Exactly. And at least in the very beginning, these weren't intentionally curated to like fool the host or the teams. So if you want to win a bar argument, you can cite the Guinness Book of World Records, which says Candid Camera is the, quote, first TV show to regularly feature members of the public as stars. 1950s, game shows getting a little wild, getting a little experimental in that post-World War II boom for the U.S. Contestants are, like you mentioned, Anna, they're put in these increasingly strange situations, stunts, practical jokes that make you think, that is embarrassing, or, oh, are they okay? And the emphasis here is on fun and awkwardness instead of like real difficult stuff like solve these riddles three. It's more like, can you move while we're throwing all this, foam at you? And this is, again, this argument is why you'll hear some people who are a little more rigorous with their definitions say the real first reality TV show came in 1973.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elia Kani, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I don't agree with it. I think it's maybe the first of its kind of reality show. It's called An American Family. And weirdly enough, it was on PBS, which we don't always associate with reality shows today so much as documentaries, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, PBS loves those commercials.
Yeah, totally. That's the sort of the blurry line that we're talking about, though, because then you have like, you know, isn't a reality show just kind of a low rent documentary to some degree? And I mean, again, please don't take that the wrong way. I just mean, you know, a documentary tends to be about something a little more like high minded and like culturally important, whereas, you know, reality shows are more about like awful people yelling at each other and getting into fights and acts of one-upsmanship. But they use similar techniques and production styles. So like, what differentiates a documentary from a reality show?
I think a documentary is more of a kind of like an investigation into something. But reality TV, I think, is just more of a like a bird's eye view into like a group of people. I think like when you're watching reality TV, you're not really fully coming to a consensus about something versus like a documentary. You're still trying to build a narrative arc, you know? I mean, you kind of are in reality TV depending on the show, but like it's not as like important where I'm dying to know what this like housewife's, you know, from Real Housewives like arc is. I'm kind of like, okay, I see her trying to, like, it's like they're literally creating their own storylines by starting a fight versus like a director of a documentary who's like, here's the story I'm trying to tell. Here are the people I'm trying to like investigate and or like examine under a lens of some kind.
Well said. I think I would agree with that, because then by that reasoning, we're saying that, for example, a documentary about the plight of the Emperor Penguin is meant to have the audience kind of cohere on the same conclusion, right? Like, oh, snap, things are bad for penguins, but a reality show is totally fine with an audience being divisive, right? Hashtag team this person, hashtag team that person, right? So from what I understand, there are fan contingents of various modern reality shows who kind of beef with each other on the internet. Is that correct? Or is that just one bad example I saw? Or is that a normalized thing?
No, I mean, yeah. It's like sports teams. You have your side. You will fight the other. Like if you love a certain housewife and someone else is coming at them, you're going to get angry. I mean, it really is like we have our teams. And people, especially now in this internet age, have no problem coming for you. So naturally, it is an extension of, you know, like a sportsmanship sort of.
I see. And this only becomes more apparent as we move toward the modern age, the dawn and the domination, it won't work, of reality television. So the 90s, we mentioned, that's like a golden age for this kind of TV for a lot of people. May 1992, MTV comes through with The Real World. This is like a Promethean act for so many other production companies because they see the fire. Reality-based soap opera, you know the drill. I can't do the intro from memory, but I'm sure so many of us listening today are already kind of reciting it like a litany. I know it ends with when folks stop being polite and start getting real. I can't remember the rest. So real.
I think that was the most important part. But no, I mean, I think that's, you know, and then they obviously branched off into, they took it on the road with Road Rules. And then there's like, you know, combinations and like sort of like anniversaries. Now there's the challenge and all that kind of stuff. But what I think is interesting too, is you have all of these offshoots of shows like this coming from other countries. Like you have Big Brother, which essentially took the Real World format and just gamified it. you know, which I think was kind of a stroke of genius. Because as you said, not everyone loves drama and everyone also loves a competition. So let's combine the two.
Yeah, and then make it like 24/7 because we cannot get enough content.
Yeah, yeah. And everything can spin off, right? So producers, networks lean in. They grow their own programming. Reality TV becomes like one of the next, the things that many networks feel are matters of survival for them. And there's one of the next steps that you had pointed out in the research, Anna, that really stood out to me. At some point, the folks who greenlight everything said, why are we casting regular folks? Why are we jumping through these hoops to find a regular person, a civilian, doing something interesting, who is also reliably camera ready? Why are we doing all that and then growing a following for them when we could start with celebrities, people who are already somehow famous, who already have their own built-in massive audience? And that feels like a sea change to me. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, like in the early 2000s, I think late Osborne started, I feel like late 90s, early 2000s, can't remember the exact date, but they basically just found Ozzy Osbourne, who in all sort of like who we knew him as was a like metal rock star, like eight bats, you know, like all these sort of lore where you're like, he's wild, he's crazy. And then all of a sudden they're like, but he has a home life and he's a father. And you're like, whoa. And I think at that time, that was really, really wild to see that Ozzy Osbourne, he had a wife, he had two kids. They had very, you know, they were, you know, quirky and weird because, you know, they're a family of like rock star kids, who knows. But they also had very normal interactions and had normal, very like family style situations they'd be in. And I think that was kind of like the point where they were like, oh, like, we love celebrities. We're obsessed with knowing what celebrities are up to. This is pre-social media, so you really don't know. Like at that time, it's like you couldn't literally watch what someone was doing all day in their Instagram stories, right? So it's like this moment, this window into this celebrity lifestyle that we also use. So, you know, glamour, big houses. It's just like, wow, everything we strive for. And then they like put it in a TV show on MTV and we were part of the Osbournes. We were in the family. We could see them every single, you know, week doing their thing. And all of a sudden they were like, your family. You know, in a weird way, Ozzy Osbourne is the father of America's family. Crazy. But it worked. It just hit in a way that we were, you know, I'm sure they were probably like, let's try it and see if anyone's even interested in seeing what Ozzy Osbourne's doing.
Exactly.
All of a sudden, Sharon Osbourne is, you know, like we're all like fans of like Kelly. You know, you're like, wow, like all these people are all of a sudden fully invested in the Osbournes, even though maybe they never even listened to Ozzy Osbourne to begin with.
Well, and by many accounts, a lot of this stroke of genius really was coming from Sharon, for better or for worse, largely, I think, for worse. It sure seemed like they were trotting out Ozzy during a time in his life where he maybe wasn't the best idea for him to be on TV all the time, you know, but it was sort of like, ah, it's fine. He'll be fine. I think he was going through some, you know, still going through some addiction problems and some like kind of, you know, doctor shopping kind of scenarios. And it was certainly clear that he wasn't fully there, but yet there he was, sort of America's, you know, kooky granddad. But this really opened the gate for like all kinds of these other types of shows like that. But it didn't really happen right away, which I thought was interesting. It wasn't until I guess VH1 started doing, you know, the Surreal Life and those, these kind of like, again, Big Brother situations, but with kind of, you know, also ran celebrities. Do you see a correlation there? Am I wrong? Was it right on the heels of it or wasn't there kind of a little gap?
Well, I think it was, I think Osbourne's kind of started to pave the way. And I think what you were saying about Ozzy really still struggling in his life, like we love dysfunction and we love to see it because again, it's not our problem. You know, it's like, we're watching it. Like we are watching from a bird's eye view where we get to what, like, we're like, damn, that sucks for Ozzy. Hope he's okay. All right, next show. You know, you're able to remove yourself in that way, but you're still at the same time able to be like a voyeur into their lives. And same situation with A Simple Life. Like Nicole Richie struggled with addiction for years. And we were still watching her go to like farms and be like, ugh, poo, you know, like cow poo. And we'd be like, that's hilarious. That's hilarious. Mm-hmm. They hate this. They're like rich girls. They've never stepped in cow shit before. But like, we loved it.
Isn't that another kind of like almost a not reverse Schadenfreude, where it's like, because I still think everything we're saying sort of points to the idea of like, okay, Ozzy's all messed up, but I'm getting a thrill out of it, and then I don't have to think about it when I turn the channel. So it's sort of like, at least it's not me, not in my backyard, but I'm definitely going to like get some sort of weird, sick joy out of watching someone else struggle. With the surreal or the simple life, is it an example of seeing people that are way, way more wealthy than you'll ever be able to be, but also kind of putting themselves in foolish situations and sort of making fun of themselves and allowing you to kind of laugh at them, even though sort of the joke's on you because you're paying for their lifestyle by participating in the whole thing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're all kind of in like a vicious cycle, for sure. And I think now more than anything, we kind of see like the genius of Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie to be like, oh, we knew damn well that we were playing ourselves dumb because we knew it would be good television. Mm-hmm, and so like there is kind of that like other side of like, oh, I thought they were fools. Turns out they were actually self-aware enough to know like if we play it dumb enough, people will keep coming back to like make fun of us. And they were able to take it. I mean, it's all very there. I mean, let's be real. There's a dark side to all of this. We're all obsessed with darkness in a way.
Sure.
That's why we love the 24-hour news cycle, really. Like, we're all so in it that we're like, we are almost addicted to being upset over darkness. But like, it's all just a vicious cycle. Who knows if there's ever going to be a way out? Maybe a giant wave from climate change will take us out, you know?
Yeah. That'll be our way out. Maybe. Maybe there will be a reality show called I Still Have a Lawn. And it's about people who still have lawns. But it's funny you say that because we are describing some key points of the American consciousness, you could call it, or I would call it the Western consciousness now with the expansion of this stuff. Years back, a little war story, Anna, I pitched our pal Connell Byrne an idea for a good news show. And I said, let me do a show where we're not always, where we're kind of fighting back against the news cycle of horrible things. And we had a call about it. We had a pitch. And then he said, it'll never work. People like darkness. And I was surprised by how blunt he was, but I still think that show would have worked. Maybe a wave of climate change.
No, someone did that. It was that dude from The Office, I want to say. Yeah. Krasinski. He did like a good CIA news psyop. YouTube thing. And it went well.
People sold it for so much money.
That's right. It was for a lot of money. And now, honestly, Colin, I haven't heard a thing about it.
Show.
But I haven't heard a thing about it since. It was during COVID where I think people were really in need of that.
Yeah.
And then once everyone thing was kind of back to normal, I think it's like, now who needs feel-goodery? Let's go back to wallowing misery.
I was ahead of my time. But it turns out whomever came up with the idea for The Bachelor, which you know a ton about, Anna, they were arguably also ahead of their time. Hold the phone. Hold the remote control. We mentioned the Bachelor. And Noel, as you and I know, that is one of Anna's areas of expertise. I think my friend, this just turned into a two-parter. What say you, Sir Brown?
Yeah, totally. It's something that we planned the whole time, though, right? No, we didn't. Bachelor content has a way of ballooning. It's just it's a lot that goes into it. And not to mention, I mean, it may sound like we're just kind of rapsing, you know, philosophical about reality shows in general, but there really is an interesting historical trajectory to all this stuff. And there are connections and threads throughout that I think we try our best to pull apart to some degree.
Mm-hmm. And I love the idea about The Bachelor ballooning because it's affected ridiculous history. We're spinning this off into a second episode.
I thought you were going to say a whole new series.
A whole new series. It's whoops, all part twos. That's what we're calling it. Here's our plan, folks, fellow ridiculous historians. We know this is a Thursday. We are going to get cranking away on the second episode, which will be coming to you on the very next Tuesday. We can't wait to hear your thoughts about reality TV. As you can tell, there's a lot of stuff in here that surprised Noel and Max and myself about the history. And thank goodness we've got the one and only Anna here to guide us through. I think we're going to learn a lot about The Bachelor. I don't know. Do you know much about it, Noel?
I mean, I know that it looms large in popular culture, that's for sure. But no, honestly, I barely know how it works. I mean, it's sort of just another in a long line of these type of dating shows and escalations. You know, I'm more of a singled out kind of guy, or even like The Dating Game from back in the day. It's just a more elaborate version of those, unless I'm completely out of my tree.
Do you guys know the recurring SNL segment? I don't think they do it anymore, but it's just like the knockoff of it. It's like, what, like one time we'd be like, car hunk. It's whoever's the host that week. They'll be sitting there and like they just like rotate like quick, like probably about 10 second conversations where it's like, oh, I like this. So tell me about yourself. And they just keep rotating it through and through and through. And it's like a very much obviously a parody of The Bachelor.
Can I steal him for a second?
Okay.
I like this. Yeah, that's awesome. It's based on an improv game that's quite a lot of fun as well. We are going to learn about all of this with an eye toward history and what reality television says about society in general in part two. So do tune in. As always, thanks to our super producer, Mr. Max Williams, the bachelor of the, like, in the game show, would you be the bachelor? What kind of game show would we be on? We could do a prank show.
Maybe, or maybe more. You ever watch Deal or No Deal? I was getting my oil changed once, and I learned how Deal or No Deal works after being completely mystified by it for years.
That's an A-plus game show, by the way. That is an excellent game show, in my opinion.
I agree. We actually didn't want to leave, even after my car was ready.
Right. And though you were telling me that an absolute stranger started breaking down Deal or
That's
No
right.
Deal for you
That's
guys.
That's exactly right. Yes. This was a momentous moment in my life. It was me and my kid, and the stranger saw that we were perplexed and was like, let me help you guys out.
It's and all then we leverage and negotiation.
Yeah. 100%. It actually can teach you some good skills. You know how to negotiate your own self.
That's one thing I love about Atlanta. It's not a perfect city, but man, it's a friendly one. So thanks also to the good people of Atlanta. Thanks to you for tuning in. Noel, thanks to you, man. And of course, thanks to Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister, who will 100% be appearing on our reality show.
Long may he reign. Thanks to Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit. Maxwell Vaughn Williams. First of his name, I believe. I don't know why am I getting all Game of Thronesy all of a sudden? It has nothing to do with reality television. But it is what it is. Alex Williams, who composed our theme and doesn't have a medieval-sounding name treatment from me.
Of course, Eve's Jeffcoat, and where would we be without our research associates, Jeff Bartlett and Zach Williams?
Oh, and once again, thanks to Anna, and to Ben, thanks to you. I look forward to rejoining you in real time very soon.
I like this.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Avalon Waterways. Ben, are you in major need of a vacation right now?
Noel, you're a mind reader. I am, and aren't we all?
We are. While cruising remains popular, there's something big happening in the industry, and that is, my friend, smaller ships.
True story. The intimate ships of Avalon Waterways can go where the big ships can only dream, through winding passageways of rolling vineyards and castled hills into the heart of timeless cities and storybook villages.
That sounds like a delight. See how Avalon's smaller ships promise greater discoveries, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at avalonwaterways.com.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.